Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
It's a very glamorous topic. This is the largest slave revolt there's ever been in the history of the world, not just in the history of the Americas, but in the history of the ancient world. It's the only slave revolt that one can say was truly successful. This means it has attracted a lot of superficial attention. There's been an enormous number of popular histories of the Haitian Revolution.
But one of the issues that really interests me is the impact of slavery, the impact of Caucasian hegemony, cultural hegemony, and aesthetic hegemony on black people.
For Black History Month 1990, the second in a series of discussions this week on Soundings, my guests are Colin Palmer of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and David Genghis of the University of Florida. First on the program this week, Colin Palmer discusses his study of the pre-emancipation experiences of blacks in the Americas. Following that, David Genghis discusses his study of the Saint-Domingue Slave Revolt of 1791 and the French Revolutionary Period in the Caribbean. Here is Colin Palmer.
I'm really interested in writing perhaps the first integrated history of the evolution of black life in the Americas. It's designed primarily to examine the evolution of several millions of individuals in different cultural contexts. And here I'm interested not so much in what blacks did for whites or what whites did to blacks, but my emphasis is on what did these people do for themselves during the time when they were slaves.
All right. Now, you're not writing, therefore, about slavery as an institution or the ill social effects, the byproducts, all of that sort of stuff.
No, I'm not. I'm focusing essentially on the institutions that these individuals created over time.
All right. And by that, you mean what? Family, religion, oral literature, education? What directions
all
do you
take? All of those and more. Because an important part of the study will be the free blacks, the kinds of mutual aid societies that freed blacks created.
All right, before we get into some of the details, Colin Palmer, give me a time frame. You're working from when, roughly to when?
Essentially from 1502, when slavery was established in Hispaniola, until the mid-19th century when it began to end. So it's a big leap. It's a big chunk of time.
All right. Well, now come back to what you were just saying there a moment ago about free blacks. Why, for instance, would a topic like that be important to you as you look at black life without looking at slavery, for instance?
It's important in the sense that slavery merely sets the institutional framework within which these individuals, as individuals, were operating. Many of them were living quiet lives. Many of them were starting religious groups. Many of them were starting families. Many of them were attending schools run by freed blacks across the hemisphere. Freed blacks essentially existed in a very precarious situation. Of course, they had certain disabilities. They couldn't do certain things. But on the other hand, there were many things that they could do. And one of those things was to lay the foundation, the institutional foundation of black life as we know it today.
For example, they weren't politically influential necessarily, but culturally they were influential.
Politically in the Caribbean, the British Caribbean in particular, in the 19th century when they spearheaded the abolitionist movement and when they started newspapers.
So they were politically
active. Yes.
All right.
And in the United States. Frederick Douglass, Henry Highland Garnett, David Walker, all of these people played very important roles, not only in launching a sustained struggle against slavery, but in starting churches, schools, abolitionist societies, mutual aid organizations, mm-hmm. and so on. Number one, they all perceive themselves as Africans. That's quite clear, given the difficulty we have now about nomenclature. Mm-hmm. The term African is used almost exclusively by these individuals. So that would suggest a profound sense of identity with the continent. Secondly, one sees a profound sense of identity with other blacks. The notion that as long as slavery existed, all blacks were on free. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, the recognition that they had as free people, that it was their responsibility to do something about those who remained enslaved. Mm-hmm. And fourthly, you see a vision of the future. What should blacks do in a world in which they constituted a minority, particularly in this country? How should they carve out the future? What ought to be the priorities? And if you look at the writings in the early 19th century, you see these terrible intellectual battles being fought out.
Among the blacks themselves.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Different visions, competing visions of the future. And of course, later, towards the end of the 19th century, this flowers into a lot of squabbles among the more literate.
Sure, the rise of the NAACP,
yes,
things
right.
like that.
Booker T. Washington,
sure.
Du Bois,
yeah.
Garvey.
All right, now, Colin people. Palmer, you have mentioned names like Frederick Douglass. That may not be, unfortunately, a household name. It certainly uh-huh. ought to be. How do you recover all this stuff?
Again, since this is a study that encompasses many different societies, let me just use two examples. In Mexico, where I've done a great deal of my own primary research, the Catholic Church has been invaluable in this regard. The Holy Office of the Inquisition actually...
That's an ironic spin, isn't it?
Holy Office of the Inquisition brought slaves up on a variety of charges, witchcraft, sorcery, bigamy, and so on.
So those were bad things then,
yes,
but they're good for a modern historian.
Yes, because you can read those very sensitively.
Yeah.
Because in the testimony, you will get a sense of what the slaves actually believed in. Mm-hmm. What were their values? What were their mores?
Well, let's talk about Christianity, for example.
Yes.
I remember hearing you earlier in another conversation here at the center talk about the mixed blessing of Christianity amongst black people,
yes,
in the 18th and 19th century.
And perhaps today.
Well, fair enough. Talk to me about that.
I say that as a Christian, of course.
Tell me about that.
I have long believed that... that the Christian religion has had a pernicious effect psychologically on blacks.
Because of its doctrines or because of the effects of its doctrines?
The effects of the doctrines, in particular, the imagery of a white savior, uh-huh, for example.
And Cain and Abel and all of that?
Yes, all of the images are white.
Yeah.
And the savior is actually of the same phenotype as that of the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that the black slave who's brought from Africa, who's conquered, brought to these shores, and then is exposed to a religion which, in all of its aesthetic impulses, reflect that of the
oppressor.
Of the oppressor.
Sure.
And that ought, I suspect that that had a pernicious impact on these individuals. And don't forget also that in this country and elsewhere, the church tended to be on the side of the slave owners. There are catechisms, for example, that were prepared to instruct the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite catechisms was published in the 1840s. And one of the questions that the slaves were exposed to was... Who made you? God made me. Why did God make you? To grow a crop.
Mm-hmm. Well, your colleague Eugene Genovese has demonstrated amply that Christianity, unfortunately, biblical allusion, reference, became much in the service of racial oppression.
Yes.
The justification.
Yes.
All right. Well, now, as you look at this phenomenon, Colin Palmer, do you go back and what are you doing? Are you condemning? Are you describing? Are you, in effect, pulling lessons from the past to teach us how to act in the future? What might be the purpose here?
I'm doing all of those and perhaps more.
Mm-hmm.
I want to emphasize, to examine how a people, given all of the things going on around them, sought to retain a sense of self.
And they did.
To some extent, they did.
Uh-huh.
And
Now let me stop you for a moment. Is your argument that this was a triumph of the black self in spite of all of this white oppression? Or
only in part. Uh-huh. I know that... The most recent books have tended to extol black resilience, black strength, and the enormous capacity of black people to endure.
The family.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And what do you say
and
to
And there's
that?
A great deal of that there.
Uh-huh.
But I am not sure whether that tells the complete story.
What's missing?
Well, I doubt whether individuals who were slaves could survive an institution and walk away an institution like that and walk away from it psychologically unscathed.
Well, you know, we've had a spate of books, a number of books recently, Colin Palmer, things like The Color Purple and
yes.
Toni Morrison's fiction, in
yes.
which we have portraits of the strength of the black female.
Yes.
Now, react to that for me. Are those romanticized views? You, as a historian, come at it from not necessarily a better point of view, but a different point of view. How do you respond to those?
I would say that's one of the possible ways to look at this.
Uh-huh.
But I think the situation is much more complex than that.
Wait, you mean by complex, you mean what? Grim or better or worse? What?
I wouldn't use the word grim,
uh-huh.
but I think I am suggesting that there is a degree of romanticism now about slavery and the capacity that black people exhibited to endure under that institution.
Uh-huh.
I'm suggesting here that given the politics of the moment, we have tended to emphasize, perhaps to exaggerate, the strength of the individuals who were slaves. We don't want to see black people as super individuals here. They were people.
But we don't want to see them as victims altogether.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to go back to the Stanley Elkins Sambo personality.
Yeah.
But what I would like to suggest here is that we had a range of responses to the institution. I think we are in a society in America today that's undergoing enormous turmoil. The black condition is not good, to be negative for a moment. There are serious problems out there in family life, in crime, the high dropout rate in schools, the continuing pernicious effect of racism. So in a sense, the book is going to say to individuals, you've got to draw strength from the past.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to look at the lessons of the past, but you can't stop there. You've got to command the future, and you've got to look internally, as the slaves did, to clean up this house.
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation with Colin Palmer of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During his fellowship year at the center, Colin Palmer is working on a study of the pre-emancipation experiences of blacks in the Americas. Soundings for Black History Month 1990 continues. My guest now is David Geggis of the University of Florida. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Geggis is at work on a study of the Saint-Domingue Slave Revolt of 1791 and the French Revolutionary Period in the Caribbean. Here is David Geggis.
Firstly, the Slave Revolt of 1791 did not take place in some remote corner of the Third World, which we now tend to think of Haiti as being, but rather in one of the wealthiest colonies of the later 18th century. Saint-Domingue, in the period between the American and French revolutions, was producing something like half of all the sugar and coffee then consumed in Europe and the Americas.
How many human beings are we talking about when we're talking about the slaves and the masters, and how do you divide those numbers up, David?
Well, colonial statistics are rather unreliable, but on the eve of the French Revolution, we're talking about something like 500,000 slaves, not a great deal fewer than all the slaves in the United States.
In a geographical area, how big, roughly?
Something a little bit larger than Maryland, probably.
Goodness.
No more than 2.5 times the size of Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Along with those 500,000 slaves, there were something like 40,000 white people and a similar number of what were called free coloureds. These were people largely of mixed racial descent who constituted a sort of middle class in the colony.
All right, now I'm going to sit here wide-eyed and ask you a large question, David Geggis. What caused the rebellion? What brought it on?
Well, historians fall into two camps broadly. I mean, those who stress greatly the importance of the French Revolution, those who say it's inconceivable that there would have been a Haitian Revolution without the French Revolution, and those who, on the other hand, look to indigenous causes of the revolution that shook this very wealthy colony through the 1790s. And the most extreme of these historians would say that the French Revolution is really a peripheral event here. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at is the long gestation of internal discontent that burst forth at the time of the French Revolution, which was a necessary catalyst, but no more than that.
Right, and where are you? Do you fall into one of these camps? Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a work in progress here, so I'm a bit hesitant to plump for one side or the other, but I certainly tend to stress the importance of 1789 and the events in Paris. We certainly can't marginalize the French Revolution. For example, after 2 years after the slave revolt had broken out, France went to war with England and Spain. Both of these powers thought this was a wonderful opportunity for picking up a very wealthy piece of real estate for very little effort, and both invaded the colony in 1793. Mm-hmm. And what is particularly fascinating about this conjuncture is all sides in the conflict suddenly look to the blacks for support. Both the British and the Spanish invaders, and also the French government, which was rapidly pushed towards a policy of declaring slavery abolished so it could win over the slave population to keep Saint-Domingue French, even at the expense of losing the slave regime. But the Spaniards rapidly found out that they'd bitten off far more than they could chew, and the rebels preferred to take money and munitions and live it up in the frontier towns between what's now the Dominican Republic and Haiti, rather than campaign against the French. This venture, however, has generated a great deal of documentation in the colonial archives of Spain, the war archives of Spain, and that's one of the interesting avenues to pursue in finding out more about this great slave revolution.
Let's talk for a few minutes, David Geggis, about, help me with the pronunciation here, Toussaint?
Toussaint.
Toussaint Louverture, is that the way one says it?
Indeed.
Tell me about this character.
Toussaint Louverture was quite simply one of the most remarkable men of his time, which many contemporaries, even prejudiced contemporaries, were willing to admit. Many people compared him to Napoleon, and there is indeed a great deal in common between the two men. He emerges into history at about 50 years old, like most former slaves. We have no idea really when he was born, probably sometime in the 1740s. And of the first 5 decades of his life, very, very little is known. Toussaint appears during the early months of the slave revolt as an assistant to one of the chief leaders, a man called Georges Biassou, and over the next couple of years he becomes a leader in his own right, leading a small band of soldiers, but with enormous skill. He emerges quite early on as a military leader of astonishing boldness, who achieved victories more by the use of cunning, duplicity, daring than outright military force.
How did he die?
Well, we'd have to jump forward 10 years here. Toussaint gradually became the dominant power in the colony of Saint-Domingue. He defeated armies sent against him by the British, the Spaniards. He united the colony under his rule, eliminating his rivals from within the white community and within the free coloured community. And this story reaches a climax like a classical tragedy in 1801, 1802, when Napoleon rises to power in France and has to make a decision about what to do with this formerly wealthiest possession of the French Empire.
And what was that decision?
Now, Napoleon decides to send a military expedition to reassert French control in the colony and then subsequently to re-establish slavery there. And this gave rise to the War of Independence, which lasted for 2 years, which created enormous carnage and destruction, and which left the independent state of Haiti, which emerged in 1804, in a great deal of ruin. Its economy was ruined. For example, much of its male population had been slaughtered in the attempt. Toussaint disappeared halfway through this struggle. He initially, after putting up a brave rearguard action against the French invaders, had surrendered on the understanding that slavery would not be restored. The French merely wished to reassert their political control in the colony. He thereafter was lured into a trap, bundled onto a ship and sent back to France, where Napoleon, who regarded him as one of his public enemies number one, we could say, imprisoned him in a dungeon in the French Alps, where he died within about, 6 or 9 months.
Let me be a little impertinent with you, David Geggis. Was the revolution worth it? You characterize all of this carnage, all this suffering and misery. Is that, what, a proper question for a historian to consider looking back on it?
It's a question that's not very often posed, I think. One, I suppose it is a rather embarrassing question to consider. It's also a difficult one, this sort of moral equation, how you work out what the proper elements are that one should put into it. I suppose if, from the standpoint of contemporary Haiti, if you asked modern Haitian peasants, would they have preferred to remain part of the French Empire, like Martinique and Guadeloupe, which of course are still effectively colonies of France, probably the answer may be yes, considering the much higher standard of living enjoyed in those countries. On the other hand, you have to consider what had happened in the 19th century. Probably the average Haitian peasant lived quite well compared to his brothers who were still in slavery elsewhere in the Caribbean. Though I think it is slightly troubling that those who have glorified the Haitian Revolution tend to be academics who sit back in their offices and say what a splendid chapter this was in the history of mankind, which indeed, of course, it is in a sense. But for example, few contemporaries could believe that the slaves of Saint-Domingue acted on their own initiative when they rebelled in August 1791. Various theories were put forward as to what other elements were involved in the rebellion. For example, the free colored community or secessionist planters. But the most popular version was that the slave revolt was some sort of counter-revolutionary maneuver staged either by royalist officers in the colony who wished to gain the upper hand over the planters who were of radical sympathies, or an even more elaborate plot staged by the brothers of Louis XVI in northern Italy, who wished to ruin the colony of Saint-Domingue in order to bring the revolution to a halt in France.
Doesn't this just unnecessarily complicate it? Can't we simply say that these are human beings who want to lift the yoke of oppression? Is that altogether too simplistic?
No, I mean, that's your starting point, obviously, when dealing with any slave revolt. But one of the interesting features of this one is that the slaves of the rebels of 1791 don't say very much at all about the rights of man, as one might imagine.
The political rhetoric.
Yes, the political rhetoric they adopt is not the libertarian ideology of the French Revolution, as we think of it, but rather a counter-revolutionary rhetoric, a church and king discourse. They claim to be defenders of Louis XVI, who, incidentally, they said, had just freed them or accorded them 3 free days per week. This is one of the difficult interpretive problems one has, is these sort of rumors, what status did they have? Were they believed, half-believed? Were they thought up by a student to manipulative leaders? And this becomes more of a problem than one might think, because the Saint-Domingue slave revolt is one of a new type of slave revolt where these rumors become quite prominent. It was not exactly the first. This sort of syndrome begins in 1789 in Martinique. It becomes a common model for slave rebellions over the next 30 to 40 years.
So that your problem is not just the documentation, goodness knows, tracking that down, but what, the innuendo surrounding the documentation?
Well, yes, to go to the other extreme of just the detective work level, there is the sort of broad general interpretation, saying what does this have to do with the French Revolution? What was the impact of the Great Revolution in Paris on the different slave societies of the New World? I think one of the curious sidelights I came across on the slave rebellion was that the slave rebels referred to the white colonists as the monkeys, macaco. Which is rather curious because of the reversal of the traditional stereotypes. It also raises the question of exactly what was going on in the slaves' mind. Why did they perceive their former masters as monkeys? The reason they did it, I think, is twofold. One, it's probably a visual image. These were people with pale faces and dark hair. But also it picks up on observations made by other Europeans about the Frenchmen in the time of revolution. That was the depth to which they were moved by revolutionary ideas, the fact that they gesticulated, argued, and grew very passionate during this period.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion with David Geggis of the University of Florida. During his fellowship year at the center, David Geggis is working on a study of the Saint-Domingue slave revolt of 1791 and the French Revolutionary period in the Caribbean. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 489. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Soundings for Black History Month 1990 continues next week. Listen for James Arnold of the University of Virginia. Our topic will be the literary history of the Caribbean. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of this year, the National Humanities Center will sponsor two enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1990. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The first magazine published in North America appeared 249 years ago this week. Andrew Bradford published The American Magazine just 3 days before the appearance of Benjamin Franklin's General Magazine. The battleship Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor during the second week in February 1898. Remember the Maine became a war cry, and the United States declared war against Spain the following April. In accordance with a treaty signed by Pietro Cardinal Gasparri and Benito Mussolini, Vatican City became an independent state during mid-February 1929. Birthdays this week include Thomas Alva Edison, the inventor and holder of more than 1,200 patents, born during the second week in February 1847. Charles Darwin, the naturalist, and Abraham Lincoln, America's 16th president, were both born during mid-February 1809. The social reformer Susan Anthony, born in 1820, and the artist Grant Wood, born during mid-February 1892. Finally, happy birthday this week to Thomas Malthus, the English economist and demographer, born in mid-February 1766. Thomas Malthus stated that world population would outstrip world production. His theories continue to provoke controversy. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Black History Month 1990, the second in a series of conversations this week on Soundings. Colin Palmer of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill discusses the pre-emancipation experiences of blacks in the Americas. David Gagas of the University of Florida discusses the Saint-Domingue slave revolt and the French Revolutionary period in the Caribbean. New World Blacks, Black History Month, this week on Soundings.